wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this April 26th Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews David Quammen, a journalist of science who wrote the book Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. Published in 2013, it eerily predicted the COVID pandemic. They discuss viral epidemics and the great threat humanity faces should a virus develop that is both easily transmitted and very virulent. They also discuss what humans can do to prevent the development and spread of dangerous viruses. Luisa Martinez interviews Sharon Rudall, artist and writer of A Graphic Biography of Paul Robeson, Ballad of an American. Rudall was commissioned by Rutgers University Press to create the novel both as a way to honor Robeson, a Rutgers alum, and to make a biography of him accessible to people of all ages. Robeson was a world-renowned African-American athlete, singer, actor, scholar, and activist who fought for anti-colonialism, civil rights, and international peace. The book was published in honor of his graduation from the university in 1919. And we'll conclude today's program with Jan Hawken talking with Taylor Gibson about May Day events this year, highlighting a picnic and march in support of the Protecting the Rights to Organize Act of 2021, or PRO Act, passed by the House in Congress but up against considerable odds in the Senate. Gibson is secretary of the Portland DSA chapter and co-chair of the chapter's Pass the PRO Act campaign, which is part of a national DSA campaign. They talk about the importance of the legislation at this juncture in labor history and the larger struggle for racial justice. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. On April 1st, KBOO kicked off our spring membership drive. Through May 22nd, listeners, family, friends, and neighbors will have the opportunity to support KBOO Radio, an important part of our community and an indispensable source of news, politics, and entertainment, not just in trying times, but every day of the week, 24/7. KBOO is 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland. The Old Mole Variety Hour has been part of KBOO's long history, heard weekly on the Monday morning radio zine Public Affairs programming since the fall of 1989. The Old Mole focuses on politics and culture from a democratic, socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective. A perspective emphasizing egalitarian relations and democracy has carried us forward for over 32 years. We point towards grassroots solutions that are collective and radically democratic. These are trying times indeed. So before we get to this week's program, I want to encourage listeners to support KBOO Radio and programs like The Old Mole. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. While we aren't in the station to take your calls, you can show your support by giving online. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. You can text KBOO to 44-321, or you can support the Postal Service and Community Radio by mailing your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Support KBOO, support Community Radio today, and now, moving on to today's show, Bill Resnick and David Quammen.
Hello, David Quammen. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be with you.
David Quammen, a fiction writer in his youth, one of his short stories made into a movie, although 40 years after the story was published. He got tired of bartending for a living and became a superstar science journalist. Many articles in major magazines, wrote 15 books, awards for his books on viruses, and his books include Ebola, the natural and human history of a deadly virus, and spillover, animal infections, and the next human pandemic. Today we're going to discuss viruses amongst the smallest of living, in quotes, things. We're talking about their potential to wipe out much of humanity. We also discuss what can be done to protect us Homo sapiens from viruses. So, David Klarman, in your years of covering all over the world, covering viral outbreaks, writing about Ebola and SARS and the hantavirus and Lyme disease that, in fact, developed in the U.S., in your years of covering those viral outbreaks, you've spoken to and interviewed on the ground medical workers, also epidemiologists, including Anthony Fauci, epidemiologists doing research and also working to contain viral outbreaks. Tell us about their analysis of virus, that is, their biology that makes them so potentially deadly, and the warnings that epidemiologists have issued.
Yes, happy to, Bill. First of all, one little parenthetical comment. You mentioned Lyme disease. Lyme disease is not a viral disease. Lyme disease is in my book, Spillover. It is a zoonotic disease, meaning that it passes from non-human animals into humans, but it's actually a bacterium that causes Lyme disease. The rest of these are viruses. You're absolutely right. Ebola, the SARS-1 virus, the hantaviruses, Hendra virus from Australia, Nipah virus from Malaysia and Bangladesh, Marburg virus, from another African filovirus related to Ebola virus, and a number of others. Old viruses that have caused disease, like the yellow fever virus, and new viruses that have emerged in the last 60 years. And there has been a drumbeat of new viruses emerging from non-human animals and getting into humans over that period of time. I write about that in Spillover. Viruses are very simple creatures in some ways. They are genetic parasites. They are not cellular. They are just a little stretch of genetic material, either DNA or its sort of cousin molecule, RNA, a little stretch of genetic material wrapped in a protein capsule that attaches to the cells of cellular creatures, animals, plants, fungi, enters the cells, hijacks them to make copies of itself, and then comes busting out. Some viruses have actually done good for various species, including humans, over the course of evolution. We have stretches of our genome that are viral genomes that have been inserted into the human genome over the millions of years. And one of those stretches is a gene called syncytin that makes human pregnancy possible. It creates a membrane around the uterus that mediates between the mother and the fetus. Absolutely essential. A viral gene. But viruses are more famous for causing disease. And that's how we tend to think of them. A virus comes from a non-human animal and gets into humans. The human population has never seen it before. And it can cause a lot of trouble, as we are seeing dramatically over the course of the last 15 months with this, as they were calling it at the beginning, this novel coronavirus that we now call SARS-CoV-2, the causative agent of COVID-19.
And the viruses are called living because they somehow evolve themselves to reproduce. They reproduce themselves. And in the reproduction, it seems to me that says in any infected human, even if they're going to finally yield to a vaccine, but in any infected human, they're continuously reproducing. And also in the reproduction, they mutate, right? Most mutations weaken the virus. But some mutations are such that they could evade the virus, and that's the problem, right, when you have hundreds of millions, now probably billions of people on Earth who have either had the virus or certainly who will get it. There's just trillions and trillions of mutations arising every day, and it seems to me that almost guarantees that some of these variants are going to be successful or more successful than the original parent.
That's right, yes. You certainly have it right, or largely right. Viruses obey what I call the three Darwinian imperatives. They are creatures that reproduce themselves, as you said. They reproduce themselves by way of a genome, replicating a genome and creating more copies of themselves. And therefore, whether you call them alive or not, they do obey these Darwinian imperatives. And those Darwinian imperatives are, first of all, number one, make as many copies of yourself as you can, produce offspring, have babies, lay a lot of eggs. That's Darwinian imperative number one. Number two, expand yourself throughout geographical space, go forth, colonize the Earth, occupy as much habitat as you possibly can. And the third imperative is extend yourself in time, survive, persist, avoid extinction. And if you follow the first two Darwinian imperatives, make an abundance of copies of yourself and extend yourself, expand yourself in geographical space, then the likelihood is that you will achieve point three, extending yourself in time, avoiding extinction. That's what viruses do. That's all they are programmed to do. They don't think, they don't have purposes, they don't have goals, they don't have malice. They just obey those three Darwinian imperatives. And as they do, as you said, in the course of replicating, they make a lot of mistakes. They make small and large mistakes copying their genome, their RNA genome. The coronaviruses have very large genomes for the particular kind of virus that they are, single-stranded RNA viruses. Just one strand of this fairly unstable molecule, not a stable molecule like the double helix of DNA. And most such viruses have small genomes because they can't have large genomes because they make too many mistakes when they copy themselves and they just become dysfunctional. But coronaviruses have very long genomes for this kind of a virus, 30,000 letters of the RNA alphabet long. And they manage to survive because they're capable of proofreading some of their mistakes. That's unique to coronaviruses. But still, there are a lot of mutations that come in. Some of those mutations cause harm to the virus. Some of them are neutral, make no difference whatsoever to the survivability of the virus. And some of them, by sheer chance, turn out to be adaptive. And something else you said that was very important and true is that now that we have, we don't know how many millions of people, but possibly a billion or more on this planet who have become infected with this virus, and we have untold trillions of particles being produced, replications in all of these people, that gives this huge source of mutations. Mutation is natural. Mutation is random change that sometimes happens to be adaptive. And so we have this huge now supply of variation, or the virus has this huge supply, this huge source of variation, and therefore the chances of it being able to adapt to become better at infecting humans at those three Darwinian imperatives, those chances are increased simply by the magnitude of numbers at which this virus now exists. It's not the most successful virus in the world right now, but it's one of the more successful viruses that infect humans. And there are these variants that are emerging, these bouquets of mutations, some of which seem to be very fit in the Darwinian sense of survival of the fittest. The UK variant, the Brazil variant, and the South African variant, most notably. And so those are spreading through populations around the world and becoming the dominant forms. And people are concerned, are they going to evade the vaccines that we've developed? If so, we have to modify those vaccines. We have to keep working. We have to make changes. We have to create boosters. Can we do that? Yes, we can. Presumably, vaccine developers, Pfizer, Moderna, and the scientists in the academic labs who work with them are busy at that right now, examining what's necessary, if anything is necessary, to tweak these vaccines, to adjust these vaccines, or to create boosters for these vaccines so that they will be effective against the variants as well as against what's called the wild type of this COVID-19 virus.
Right. Donald Trump is really, he hasn't done much for humanity, but he's done a great service to the coronavirus, supporting other governments around the world, authoritarians.
There are three countries now that are suffering or have suffered cataclysmic caseloads and loads of morbidity and mortality due to the COVID-19, and that's the United States, Brazil, and now India, which is suffering a terrible wave right now, an incredible wave. India is on fire with this virus right now. What do they have in common? Well, one of the things they have in common is bad national leadership. And we did have bad national leadership until January 20th. Through most of the COVID-19 outbreak, we had a catastrophically incompetent, narcissistic, and ignorant president. And Brazil still has a problem with Jair Bolsonaro and Mahendra Modi in India. Those are not the only things that have gone wrong, but those are three big things that have gone wrong in those three countries.
This is Bill Resnick talking to science journalist David Quammen. He writes on viruses, reports his observations and discussions with medical workers and epidemiologists. We've just discussed the vast dangers posed by out-of-control viruses in today's world. In an op-ed in the New York Times, titled "Is Disease the Next Big One?", David Quammen wrote, "We can't prevent another malign bug from entering the human population, but will it kill a few thousand people or tens of millions? The answer may depend not just on the nature of the virus and on the density and abundance of the Homo sapiens on this planet, but also on the particulars of how we respond or do not respond, unfortunately. Viruses are," he continues, that was my insertion, "viruses are adaptable and heedless. Humans are adaptable and smart." Too smart, actually, maybe. They can mislead themselves enormously. So, David, what can be done by us smart and adaptable humans to stop these heedless viruses from killing off most of us?
Well, there are certain things that we can do, yes. First of all, we citizens need to understand better what is going on, what a virus is, how a virus works, where viruses come from. We need to get past the crackpot conspiracy theories that you can find in social media. We need to invest just a little bit of time, not just in informing ourselves, but informing ourselves with critical thinking, so that we think about not just which story is being told most dramatically, but what are the sources of the information that we're being given, and what's the empirical support? What's the evidence for those stories? We need, and these are some of the things that I highlighted in that New York Times op-ed, we need scientists who are out in the field looking for dangerous viruses, sampling viruses from non-human animals, seeing what might be coming at us, getting us a little bit ahead of the curve. We need people to be looking at the interactions between humans and wildlife, places where humans are harvesting wild animals for food, either for subsistence or for commercial purposes, shipping wild animals live to markets and selling them in food markets in the presence of other forms of meat, live domestic animals and meat and other foodstuffs and crowded corridors in these markets. Those are very dangerous situations. Factory scale husbandry of livestock, domestic animals, such as mass corrals of pigs such as the mass pork operations in northern Malaysia, can be dangerous. In Malaysia, that led to the opportunity for the Nipah virus to spill over from giant fruit bats into pigs and from pigs into humans. That can be very dangerous. We need to increase our support for science, for molecular biology, for the training of young people in molecular biology, not just in the U.S., but everywhere around the world, capacity raising, support for training medical scientists and molecular biologists in countries that have high degrees of genetic diversity and therefore high degrees of viral diversity, but in some cases, marginal resources to support medical infrastructure. Places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Brazil, huge, huge superpowers of biological diversity that are challenged in terms of their scientific and their medical resources. They have brilliant people, but they don't have the resources that they need. We need international agreements and organizations, not just the WHO and GOARN, the Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network, but more so that information can travel from one country to another fluidly, transparently, and immediately when there is a sign of a new outbreak, when a dozen or two dozen people get sick of a strange disease in a village in the southwestern United States or a village in Central Africa or a neighborhood in a city in China. We need that information to pass transparently, quickly, from one group of scientists to another so that responses can be mounted, so that we can protect against the next outbreak from becoming an epidemic that becomes a global pandemic. These are some of the things that we can do and we need to do beginning now. I've said elsewhere that when this pandemic is passed, when we get past the pandemic phase, we should celebrate for 5 minutes and then start getting ready for the next one, because there will be a next one. Nobody knows how many hundreds or thousands of coronaviruses alone are out there living in wild animals, as well as other forms of viruses that can be dangerous to humans. We need to be ready for the next one because there will be a next one.
Yeah, I think the strategies, from what I've read, is, as you pointed out, you need this early warning system. When one is discovered, the whole international community, in quotes, has to put its resources into isolating it in that area, basically locking down the area. I think that's what Australia did. Now they have a handful of cases every month, every day, I mean. But that requires a public health system that can respond immediately. And it really doesn't, unlike the climate crisis, which is around the corner, that won't require a vast amount of resources or reconstruction of everything to save humanity. It's relatively cheap, but you have to have a really healthy public health system, right? Then you have to stockpile a lot of things, drugs, vaccines. You have to keep working on vaccines.
Yes, and there's one other thing you need, Bill. You need a culture that values community health, public health, as much as it values individual liberty. All of these things we're talking about involve an inherent tension between public health and individual liberty. And that's a delicate balance that has to be walked and has to be continually discussed. And it has to be discussed with respect for the opinion on the other side of the debate. But it's absolutely necessary that balance be maintained and not be tipped too far in one direction or the other. And in this country, especially here in the West, you know, you're in Portland, I'm in Bozeman, Montana, we're in the Wild West, and we live amid the cowboy ethic, which is just one variant or one label for the American rugged individualist ethic, or let's call it the cowboy myth, because most of the people who embrace that ethic don't actually raise cows for a living. They are not cowboys, although they like to think of themselves as cowboys, and we might call them cowboys. But if you have people who are so devoted to their own rights, their own sense of being entitled to do whatever the hell they please, that is my liberty as an American, then you find it difficult to have a strong public health system because you don't have community buy-in. You don't have a culture where people are able to say, yes, my rights are important, but the welfare of my family and myself are only parts of the welfare of our community, and I care about the welfare of the community as well. My family is ultimately not going to be in good shape unless this community is in good shape. And for this community to be in good shape, this state has to be in good shape, and this country has to be in good shape. We need to have some awareness of and sensibility toward the concerns of community health, public health, as well as individual liberties. Now, you take places like Australia, you mentioned. Singapore has done well in dealing with COVID-19. South Korea has generally done well. Japan has generally done well. New Zealand locked its doors, an island out there in the Southern Pacific, and it has done well. If you're an island, which Singapore is, which Australia is, which New Zealand is, it's a bit easier to close your doors and keep something out, especially if you're not one of the major commercial and banking and financial nexuses in the world. So it's been easier for them, but it's also been easier for them because they have cultures that are not cowboy cultures, with the possible exception of Australia, which is my Australian friends, I think, would not take it amiss if I said that they have a bit of a cowboy culture, too. But so this is all part of it. This is all important.
David Quammen, thanks a lot for talking to us. You're one of the people who are really important in making that effort to develop the culture as well as create a public entities that would have the strength and the resources to actually deal with these viruses. They present a threat to the life of Homo sapiens. Anyway,
thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure to be on KBOO with you. I'm really glad for the chance to talk to you and your audience. You all stay healthy there, hang together, and we will get through this thing.
Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir. Likewise.
All right. So,
take care.
So long.
You just heard Bill Resnick's interview with David Quammen, author of the book Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. Later in the program, Louisa Martinez talks with Sharon Rudall about her new graphic biography on the life of Paul Robeson. And Jan Hawken discusses May Day and the PRO Act with Taylor Gibson, co-chair of the Portland DSA chapter's Pass the PRO Act campaign. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. On April 1st, KBOO kicked off our spring membership drive, and through May 22nd, listeners, family, friends, and neighbors will have the opportunity to support KBOO Radio, an important part of our community and an indispensable source of news, politics, and entertainment. KBOO is a nonprofit organization with 80% of our funding coming from our members. KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and writers, and KBOO has trained thousands of people to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. These are trying times indeed, and this morning I want to encourage listeners to support KBOO Radio and programs like The Old Mole. We are volunteer-powered, non-commercial, independent, member-supported community radio, and we need your support to keep KBOO on the air for another 50 years. Supporting this vital resource in our community is just a click away. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44-321 or mail your contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Next on The Old Mole, Louisa Martinez interviews Sharon Rudall, artist and writer of a graphic biography of Paul Robeson, Ballad of an American. Rudall was commissioned by Rutgers University Press to create the novel, both as a way to honor Robeson, a Rutgers alum, and to make a biography of him accessible to people of all ages. We begin this segment with Paul Robeson singing Joe Hill. In 1949, the iconic actor and singer made a visit to a coal mine to perform for Scottish miners. We begin this segment with a version of Joe Hill from the collection of recordings Songs of Free Men by Robeson and Lawrence Brown.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die, says Joe. I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they forgot to kill went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
This is Luisa Martinez, and I will be interviewing artist Sharon Rudall. Sharon provided the artwork and text for the book, Graphic Biography of Paul Robeson, Ballad of an American, is edited by Paul Buell and Lawrence Ware. Sharon marched with Martin Luther King as a teenager and began her career as a cartoonist with anti-Vietnam War underground newspapers. She was one of the founders of the 1970s-era feminist Women's Comics, spelled W-I-M-M-E-N-C-O-M-I-X. She is best known for her graphic biography, Emma Goldman, A Dangerous Woman. So, good morning, Sharon.
Good morning, Luisa.
Thanks for joining us. And let me ask, can you first tell us a little bit about Robeson's extraordinary life and career?
Well, Paul Robeson is probably the most famous African-American in American modern history that's been forgotten. I was surprised after I did this that he's still been so much forgotten. He was disappeared during the McCarthy era, and he's never entirely been brought back. He was a great athlete. He was a great opera singer and concert singer. He was a very popular actor in theater and in movies, and he was a great activist. He spoke with First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt to support the American war effort in World War II and appeared on her radio show. He was a really important representative of the Black community, and he was embraced by people all over the world as an agent of activism and change. But during the McCarthy era, he was attacked as a communist and completely disappeared from records of his athletic achievements. His movies were discontinued. He wasn't given any venues to perform, and he's still inadequately remembered.
So let me ask, why a graphic biography of Robeson? What can a graphic novel tell us or convey to us about his life where text maybe falls short?
Well, from my point of view, because that's what I do, is tell stories with pictures, Rutgers University, where Paul Robeson was an alumni, and he was Phi Beta Kappa and won 14 awards in athletics. And he was a big star of Rutgers. In spite of having a great difficulty getting in, he won by competitive exam that he was actually a racist teacher, actually kept him from knowing about the exam that would have given him free tuition, but he got in. So now Rutgers is proud of him, and it's just about the 100th anniversary of his graduation in 1919. And they decided, the people at Rutgers, that they wanted a graphic biography, and they contacted my longtime collaborator, Paul Buell. And Paul Buell contacted me. He said, because I was the only popular front artist he knew, I didn't know what that meant at the time. But apparently it means that, you know, I'll go out and work for any cause. It sounds good to me. Which put me on the same page with Paul Robeson. And I draw pretty good. So that's how I got this job. Why is it good to present it as a graphic story? I think people absorb graphic stories in a different way than they absorb print. And not to say one is better than the other, but I think there are people that can be reached by words and pictures that might not be reached by just one or the other. When I wrote the script, I tried to keep it so that if I was explaining something to my sons when they were, you know, 12 or 14, rather than little children or adults, but to make understandable what was important and complicated, but nonetheless what needed to be understandable at their level, and backing it up with pictures, I think it opens it up to more people than having it just be one or the other.
So you've committed yourself to social justice. You had Paul describe you as a popular front artist. How do you think that differentiates your art and the lens through which you express yourself versus other artists?
Well, in working on the Paul Robeson book, as with any other work where it's based on an actual person, it's something like being an actor doing a biography, in that you try to find places where what you are inside matches the person who you're trying to present. And one of the things Paul said that I really felt close to is he said, in a socialist country, I work for free. In a capitalist country, I work for as much as I can get. So in my career, there is definitely work I won't do, but there's work that's sort of morally neutral that I'll do for a good pay. And then there's work that's so important to me that I'll do whatever I have to do to stay alive to do it, even if there's no money coming in. I have to say that activist art saved me rather than the other way around. I went to an all-scholarship art school in New York at the height of the op art and canvases being either all black or all white and sculpture being metal cubes. And it was terribly frustrating. It was nothing that I had hoped for in becoming an artist. And I graduated and there was nothing I felt I could do. And I was actually approached by people who needed a poster for bail money to get someone out of jail who had been involved in anti-Vietnam War activism. And that really saved my life artistically. So, you know, it's just like people who say, I rescued this animal, but this animal rescued me. Well, activist art really gave me what I'd always been looking for in art, which was a purpose. I mean, if I had been a medieval monk, I would have done the lives of saints. As a 21st century artist, I do the life of Paul Robeson. And I find that something meaningful enough that I can put myself into it completely, which I couldn't do today. With, to me, gallery art is, it's like Bitcoin or something. I mean, don't get me started.
Well, you know, back to Robeson, there were so few opportunities for Black artists, and what was available would be universally dismissed as racist and sexist by modern standards. So, for instance, as portrayed in the book, one of his most successful plays early on in his career, The Emperor Jones, is about a railroad porter who moves to the West Indies and declares himself king and brutalizes natives. There are countless depictions of Robeson as a continental African in a really unflattering way in plays such as The Sanders of the River. And so how do you reconcile this unfortunate position that he was put in with your obligation to portray some of the humanizing aspects of his life? So when he had to play these roles that really just perpetuated racist stereotypes, how do you do it with sympathy?
Okay, so this was one of the things that I did think through. Normally when I get a job, I just kind of lunge in ahead and then, you know, try to put it into some sort of form. But I felt like I did need to deal with those roles. And what I decided to do, I don't know if you're familiar with either the movie or the play Kiss of the Spider Woman. It's a political activist and a gay man are in prison together, and they tell stories about movies with this Spider-Woman character, that the movies come to life and become the tissue that holds the story of their actual lives together. I decided to actually tell the stories in at least little snippets from them in ways that I could make them fun and not make them offensive. There's the things that you lump together are actually important to keep apart. The Emperor Jones was by someone who's supposed to be, I'm looking for this here, but he was one of the most acclaimed modern playwrights that was supposed to really understand the Black experiences and stuff. And of course, it was complete garbage and other words that I would use if we weren't on air. And most of the others you mentioned really were just popular low-level entertainments. I'd like to bring up just recently for Black History Month, they showed a documentary on Sidney Poitier on my public television station. And they were throwing the same sort of opprobrium at him, that he always portrayed a Black that was easy for whites to take. And then at the end it said, yes, but that opened the door that otherwise wouldn't have been opened for other Black performers. Well, that actually made me really mad. Sidney Poitier was a tremendous Paul Robeson supporter, and Paul Robeson's the one that opened that door. He opened it for Sidney Poitier and opened it for everybody else. Samuel L. Johnson and, you know, whatever, any Black artist, theatrical or movie artist you want to name, that door was opened a generation or two ago by Paul Robeson, by his tremendous success. You know, and it's also true. I mean, if you have any friends that are performers, getting any kind of a job is so hard. And then supporting a family and supporting your various hangers-on, people cannot afford to be that picky who are in the performing arts. But I also think Paul Robeson was just a very open-hearted, jolly, he loved to dance, he loved to sing, he loved to make music. You know, he was happy to perform. I don't think he looked at it through that lens until quite late in life, and late in his career, active career life, when he did start turning down roles if he didn't think they expressed his political views, and being a lot more forceful about choosing roles that he could embody. And I also think he got tricked a lot. Sanders of the River, I know they told him it would be actually filmed in Africa with actual footage of tribes. And I don't think he had any idea until he saw the final cut just how disparaging it was.
Okay. Well, lastly, any quick kind of words of advice for aspiring artists who do take a social justice to their artwork?
Well, following on my comments about how hard it is to get work as a performer, it's pretty hard to get work as an artist. I'd say the first thing to do is just take any opportunity you have. For me, it was doing flyers for demonstrations and posters to get people out of jail. And that's how I honed my craft. And then later working on underground newspapers, you know, for less than no pay, we had to come up with the money to print our papers. Take any opportunity you have to hone your craft, carry a sketch pad. There are new opportunities online that didn't exist when I was getting started. I don't have the specific information because I don't even know how to turn the computer on, but I've been told there's sites where you can post your work and people can comment on it and you can find a way to make small amounts of money on it and kind of build on that. But the main thing is if you really want to do it, just start doing it and keep doing it.
Thanks so much, Sharon, for joining us.
Thank you, Louisa, for giving me the opportunity.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this head below.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down my head below.
I know my rope's going to fit to me.
I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, one of these mornings bright and fair,
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load.
My wings and cleave the air.
I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
That was Paul Robeson and Lawrence Brown singing By and By, and you heard Louisa Martinez interviewing Sharon Rudall, artist and writer of A Graphic Biography of Paul Robeson, Ballad of an American. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Next on The Old Mole, Jan Hawken talks with Taylor Gibson about May Day events this year and the PRO Act. Jan?
Welcome to KBOO, Taylor Gibson, and thank you for joining me to talk about events this Saturday in celebration of May Day, which many countries and communities around the world recognize as Labor Day or International Workers' Day.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, although the September date of the holiday in the U.S. was established to repress its radical roots in the late 19th century labor movement, May Day continues in the U.S. as a time to both celebrate and organize in support of workers' solidarity. So, Taylor Gibson, you are co-chair of a campaign launched by the Portland chapter of DSA, or the Democratic Socialists of America, which is part of a national campaign in support of the PRO Act. Can you tell us about the PRO Act, this House resolution, and why it's so important this May Day?
Yeah, of course. So the PRO Act is the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, and there are six key components of what the PRO Act would do. The first thing it would do would be to override right-to-work laws and collect union dues from those who opt out in order to cover the cost of collective bargaining and the administration of contracts. It would also forbid employer interference in union elections, and that includes things like captive audience meetings and being able to cast a ballot in a union election in a location away from company property. Oftentimes, union organizing drives fail to result in an agreement on the first contract between labor and management, and the PRO Act would remedy this by allowing newly certified unions to seek arbitration and mediation to settle those negotiation impasses. It would also prevent an employer from using its employees' immigration status against them when determining the terms of their employment. It's very common in union elections for employers to threaten to tell their undocumented workers that they'll call ICE or threaten to revoke a work permit as a consequence for supporting a union drive. It would also establish monetary penalties for companies and executives that violate workers' rights. Currently, that doesn't happen. So corporate directors and other officers of a company could also be held liable. Currently, if management is found in violation by the NLRB of unfair employment practices, all they have to do is post a sign saying that they were found in violation, which doesn't really do anything. So it would give some more teeth to this. And then finally, the bill would also enable more people currently classified as contractors to be given the status of employees, which would pave the way for freelancers and gig workers to negotiate better pay and working conditions.
So this act and the fact that the PRO Act passed the House but still faces stiff odds in the Senate, I believe it's now in the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions in the Senate, it faces the usual forces arrayed against workers. But how do you see this as signaling perhaps a shift in the anti-union culture that is so deep in American politics?
I think the popularity of it within a lot of Democratic senators demonstrates the popularity and the resurging ideas around workplace organizing and the importance of union is really returning. I think when a lot of those right-to-work laws were passed in the Midwest and around the rest of the country in the 2000s, it resulted in almost essentially a generation being without understanding the importance of employee organizing, as well as the importance of how unions can make workers' rights so much better.
It seems like over the last year, there's both been the difficulty, as we saw with the Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, and the difficulty in gathering and doing a lot of the organizing that's so essential for those campaigns. On the one hand, that's been difficult this year to organize campaigns. On the other hand, the pandemic has heightened the dependence of the entire society on essential labor, on workers, often people carrying out care work or other forms of work that makes them vulnerable to the health impacts and the inequities that have been exposed by the pandemic. Do you think some of the organizing around the PRO Act has these two sides, both reflecting some of the difficulties this year, as well as kind of a call for a different kind of society that requires forms of solidarity and cooperation support that really departs from the neoliberal worldview where everyone's kind of out on their own to make their way?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that COVID has really demonstrated how poorly workers in this country are treated. I think the demands for service workers, specifically line cooks, are some of the people that are dying the most in this pandemic. Teachers have been treated poorly, given that, you know, they're concerned about their working conditions, care workers, all of these essential positions that typically don't have any union support behind these workers. I think the pandemic is really demonstrating just how important workplace organizing and unions are for worker protections. And so specifically with Amazon, what's really interesting is, although I think it's a little early for a full postmortem on what happened in Bessemer, there are a few things that I think are important to know. One being the powerful impact of employer intimidation and interference. Amazon worked very hard to mislead and manipulate their workers. They took full advantage of terrible labor laws, including hiring union-busting consultants, requiring mandatory hour-long anti-union meetings. They launched anti-union social media accounts and websites, and they blanketed the facility with posters and banners, even in the bathrooms. I mean, Amazon even had traffic light patterns changed at intersections where organizers were canvassing, and even installed its own U.S. Postal Service mailbox in front of the facility to collect ballots. And a lot of these things would be forbidden by the PRO Act. And I think another thing is that the campaign came together very quickly. I mean, it can take years to build trust with your coworkers to organize a union campaign, especially when it's, as you know, at a company as large as Amazon, where there's thousands of different employees. The way Amazon functions also makes it incredibly difficult to build a culture of organizing when your job performance is determined by how fast you're moving in the facility and you've got something tracking your activity all day long. I mean, it's very intentional on Amazon's end.
Can you speak to the PROACT as part of the broader movement for racial justice and international solidarity that includes immigrant rights? Because that has been traditionally part of the May Day celebration, is the focus on international labor solidarity, that one country's workforce gets pitted against another. And that has been also a part of what we're aware of in the world of trade during the pandemic, how interdependent the world is around health issues, around trade and economies. How does the PROACT, how do you see it as part of a larger movement around international labor solidarity?
Sure. A couple of things. So a lot of right-to-work laws are actually rooted in the history of Jim Crow. Back in the 40s, you had Arkansas and Florida becoming the first two states in the country to enact right-to-work laws. And these were anti-union measures that were meant to prevent what industrialists and planners, both in the North and the South, what they saw as interracial organizing's threat to the current, at the time, racial and economic order. And these laws were passed by ballot initiatives at a time when Black people in this country were being lynched for attempting to exercise their right to vote. And then, of course, you know, we saw these laws expanded throughout the Midwest and other parts of the country in the mid-2000s. And this intersection of workplace democracy and racial justice has never been more visible and important. I think what's important to keep in mind is that over 80% of the Amazon warehouse workers in Bessemer are Black, and the majority of them are women. And this trend is consistent with recent labor history organizing across the South. I mean, Black women have been leading unionization efforts for the last 50 years, including efforts in textile factories, auto plants, shipyards, meat processing plants, as well as hospitals. And two-thirds of union workers are women or people of color, and immigrants, refugees, and migrant workers. Black women, Black union women, earn 19% more than women without a union, and Black construction workers in New York City earn 36% more than non-union Black construction workers. Union wage premiums are the largest for low-wage sectors where jobs are primarily held by Black, Latinx, and immigrant workers in industries such as hospitality, nursing, and janitorial services. Union workers in food service and in janitorial jobs make about 87% more in total compensation and over 50% more in wages than non-union workers. And so I think what's important to know is that labor organizing and your workplace rights are essential to racial justice and racial equity. I mean, union workers not only get paid more, but they're more likely to have employer-provided health care plans and pensions and have much more vacation time. And in the wake of this most recent pandemic, there's ample evidence that unions create safe workplaces by enabling workplace democracy and protection from retaliation.
Taylor Gibson, tell us what will be happening this Saturday on May Day, which is not only a time to organize around initiatives or resolutions like the PROACT, but also to build labor culture and to celebrate and mourn, to have picnics. And there's a festive side to May Day as well as a organizing aspect, and the two are intertwined. What's happening this Saturday on May Day here locally?
Sure. We have a lot of really exciting events coming up. The Portland DSA chapter is focused on a day of action, you know, focused on organizing and solidarity and celebration. So we've got several events that we're a part of that we're really excited about. The morning activity is a rally to end the filibuster. Specifically, we are focused on targeting Ron Wyden, to put pressure on him to end the filibuster, because a lot of people believe that the only way that we're going to get the PRO Act passed is by ending that filibuster. Jeff Merkley is already on board. Ron Wyden still wants some form of a talking filibuster. So we're meeting at Holiday Park at 11 a.m. and we'll be marching to Ron Wyden's office to put the pressure on him. And then in the afternoon, we've got two other events that we're a part of. There is a May Day Migrant Workers Rise Up event. It is a car caravan hosted by the International Migrants Alliance, NAFCON Oregon, Pacific Coast Coalition for Seafarers, Portland Through a Latinx Lens, and Migrante Portland. And so that will be a car caravan, and that is a really great option for folks who may not necessarily be able to or feel comfortable attending any events in person, because everyone will obviously be in their cars. And then we also have in the afternoon a May Day rally hosted by our local Amazon Worker Solidarity Campaign at Columbia Park from 12 to 6. And that's really going to be a celebration of International Workers' Day with speakers, entertainment, and food.
Okay, so get that picnic basket ready. There's a lot going on this Saturday. Where should listeners find out more of these details?
Folks can check out the Portland DSA website, and there are also a few links to social media posts with all that organizing, which I will send to you.
And we'll post that on our KBOO site as well. Taylor Gibson, thank you so much for being with us today and talking about the campaign, the PRO Act campaign, which is nationally launched by DSA as well as with the local chapter, and for your work with the coalition around these efforts. Thanks so much for being with us, and keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio, and a big thank you to KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over this last year. It takes a labor. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m., and I want to thank our contributors and guests for making today's show possible. Bill Resnick and David Quammen, Jan Hawken and Taylor Gibson, Louisa Martinez and Sharon Rudall. John Nelson edited portions of today's program. We thank him. And you can hear The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Or you can download The Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. I want to encourage listeners to support KBOO Radio and programs like The Old Mole. You can donate today to help with our spring drive 2021. You can donate at kboo.fm/give. You can send your donation to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. And you can text KBOO to 44-321. Support KBOO, support community radio today. I am Denise Morris, and I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. Thank you for joining us.